Welcome to this morning's session for audio and video accessibility, strategies and workflows. Today's speakers consist of Terrell Thompson from the University of Washington, James Galapa Grossclog from the College of the Canyons, Sean Keegan from Stanford University, and Alice Anderson from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you.
Thank you. We are here to talk about audio and video accessibility, and this is a panel discussion. We've all got some PowerPoints to kind of go through to introduce you to what each institution is doing related to audio and video accessibility. I'll have a few remarks at the beginning. Just a few logistical things. For these slides, if you're interested, we do have them available online. Currently, they're at my staff page, which is staff.washington.edu/TFT. Got them available in both PowerPoint and PDF up there. And I think they're also going to be available through the EDUCAUSE site at some point. Don't have them up there yet. Those of you who are using Twitter, we do have a hashtag for this session. It's E10_SESS022. So feel free to share your ideas and insights through the back channel. I'm not going to be talking a whole lot about what we do at the University of Washington. I'm going to defer to these guys. But just to kind of set the stage, we do have a lot of video at the University of Washington, and I think there are a lot of institutions that are kind of in a similar boat. Just to give you some numbers, these are very rough estimates that we put together as we're sort of struggling internally with our own captioning needs and video accessibility needs. But we have 1,000 videos in 12 categories on iTunes U. We have 800 videos and 25 accounts or channels on YouTube, and that doesn't include athletics and student radio channels. We have 44 courses that are videotaping all their lectures. We have 37 courses that are audio recording or screencasting their lectures. We have 1,500 videos produced by UWTV, and we have 3,500 research channel videos hosted at the University of Washington. So lots and lots of media. It's growing all the time. And the question that we want to explore today is, how do we make all of that accessible, or how do we make as much of that accessible as possible and build accessibility into our infrastructure? A few more numbers to consider. 70% of all U.S. Internet users now watch videos online. This is according to the Pew Research Center. And on average, folks are watching 173.3 videos per month as of March of this year. That's up from 96.8 videos per month March of last year. So there's a lot of growth, obviously, in video. We all know that. These numbers support that. And every minute, 24 hours of video is uploaded to YouTube. So what are the accessibility implications with all of this video and audio? Well, video presents some accessibility challenges. People who are unable to hear it, this is what we think of generally, I think, when we think of accessibility of video. If somebody can't hear the audio, they're not going to be able to access that unless it's captioned. People who are unable to see it, if there's information that's presented visually only, where just listening to the audio alone is not going to give people access to the information that's being communicated, then that's a challenge too. And the solution is to have audio description, to have a sort of a companion narrative track that describes whatever's happening visually. People who are unable to do either, maybe somebody who's deafblind, maybe somebody who is on a slow modem connection and they simply cannot download the media. Then you know, a transcript might be a solution for those folks. People who are unable to operate the player controls. So as we deliver and deploy video, you know, a simple test, can you just use the keyboard in a browser and access all of the buttons and controls and use that media player? People with physical disabilities who are unable to use a mouse, that might be affected by that. People who are using a screen reader, if they navigate to the player, do the labels make sense? Are they verbalized in a way so that they can control the media player? People who need to search video content. So accessibility goes beyond just disability. There are lots of people that are affected by that, particularly as we're using a lot of lecture video and podcasts. And, you know, that's great information then to refer back to after the lecture. It would be really great if students could search all of that and could quickly jump right to the content that meets their needs. People who don't speak the language spoken in the video, if they could automatically translate that, then that would be a bonus for them as well. So the good news is that all of these barriers are just potential barriers. We have solutions for all of them. And here's just an example of a solution. You can see a lot of the solutions at work on YouTube. This is an example of a video that's up there on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, it's kind of a famous video of an underwater erupting volcano. It's the first one ever filmed by a UW faculty member. And this video is captioned, and the captions, in addition to providing accessibility, also make the video potentially searchable, which is one of the reasons Google's interested in it. But there's also the option there to translate captions. How many of you have played with that feature in YouTube? A few hands go up. Those of you that haven't, I encourage you to do so. Go to any video on YouTube that has captions, and you can translate those captions into any language on the fly. And folks that I've talked to that speak a number of languages have said it's pretty reliable, that it actually does a good job of translating, you know, not to the point of 100% accuracy, but enough so that a person who doesn't speak the native language of the video can at least get the idea of what's going on in the video. So there are lots of solutions and lots of people who benefit from those solutions. But in higher education, when we get so many videos that we need to deal with, the challenge then becomes, how do we deal with that systematically across our campus or across our system? What kind of solutions can we come up with? And so the panelists have actually taken some significant steps toward implementing solutions on a very large scale. And so that's why we've invited them here today to talk about what they're up to and to kind of share ideas. And so just some logistics then. We're going to start with James, and I'll just kind of go right down the line. And again, each panelist has a set of slides. They're going to deliver those slides. If you have questions for that individual, then feel free to ask those at the end of that person's slide set. We have a couple of mics here. Since it's a big room, it's going to be hard to project without using the mic, so ask you to please step forward and use the mic to ask your question. If your question pertains more to the group or you think that everybody might be able to contribute to that, then we ask you to save those questions for the end, and we'll have lots of time at the end for some discussion and a lot more interactivity. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to James.
All right, thank you, Terry. Wow, good morning, everybody. It's my pleasure to share with you information about about a system-wide approach to funding captioning projects, namely the Distance Education Captioning and Transcription Grant Program, which is a mouthful, so for the duration of the presentation, I'll use the acronym DECT. This is a program that's funded through the California Community College Chancellor's Office. So it's a system-wide approach for California community colleges. The college with which I am employed, College of the Canyons, is pleased to serve as fiscal agent for this grant and to manage the funds. What I'll talk about briefly today is what the heck is this grant funding, why take a system-wide approach, and finally, what is it that we actually fund and how does that funding mechanism work? I think it's kind of unique. Very briefly, or in the most general sense, the program provides funding for live and delayed captioning and transcription. It's a process whereby the state, via the California Community College Chancellor's Office, devotes between $500,000 and $750,000 per year of funding to distribute to colleges, to local colleges, or captioning vendors to support the projects that they need to have captioned. And I'll talk more about how that process works in a second. More broadly, it's a system-wide commitment to support all students, support access for all students. It's a recognition, of course, that distance education is the fastest-growing segment of California community colleges, and I think pretty much in the United States, in higher ed in the United States, it's the fastest-growing sector. and it's most specifically financial support for these activities. Why take a system-wide approach is I think a most interesting question for this group. The California Community Colleges represent a large system, first of all. It's the largest system of higher education in the U.S., and I think it's the largest system of higher education in the world. It's 112 community colleges. We serve almost 3 million students a year. If the state funded us properly, we'd be able to serve twice that many. The background, the immediate impetus for this grant project came out of a Office of Civil Rights finding against the largest educational system in the United States in 1999. The Office of Civil Rights found that the California community colleges were systematically making education inaccessible to students, violating federal law. The state responded, or the California community colleges responded in a number of ways, most significantly by creating three statewide projects. Some of you may be familiar with these. The High Tech Training Center Unit is charged with developing and delivering training and technical assistance to faculty and institutions in designing accessible classes and accessible courses. The Alternate Text Production Center is charged with providing and producing alternate text to colleges, and the Distance Education Capturing and Transcription Grant provides that funding for making capturing and transcription available. So more specifically, what is available or what is eligible for funding? First of all, it's distance education content, instructional content, broadly defined. So online class content for online classes, content for hybrid classes, but most specifically, instructional content, not the broadcast of your football game, not the broadcast of your board meetings, not the broadcast of the president's speech, but rather instructional content. We also include in that digital learning object repositories, so very, very broadly, any content that can be used and reused, shared and repurposed, we're very, very happy to devote these resources to having captioned. That includes, of course, live or synchronous captioning, delayed or asynchronous for distance education, and it includes 4 credit, and this is maybe splitting hairs too much, but if you're familiar with this, it will make sense. It includes 4 credit and non-credit classes, in other words, classes that for which the state provides funding to educate the students. It doesn't include community education classes, so the walking tour of old Los Angeles that your college might put on, or the water aerobics for seniors that your college might put on as a community service. It doesn't include those kinds of things. There are 2 funding processes in place. The first one, which I consider the hard one, you see that very sophisticated graphic there, implying that it's a hard way to get the money. Your college your college has a captioning project that needs to be done. You choose a vendor that you want to work with. You choose a vendor that you want to work with. You apply, do some paperwork with my office. The vendor does the work. You pay the vendor, and then you turn around to my office and we reimburse you. Now, in normal times, and maybe in normal states, that's not a great financial burden to put out some of that money float that money for a month or so. But certainly within the California context these days, if our crazy finances, it is pretty hard for a lot of colleges to float that money even for a month. So the much preferred process is what we call, in a very sophisticated way, again, funding process B, or payment method B. You see, again, the graphic that implies that this is the good way to go. If your college chooses to work with some vendors with whom we have a relationship, for a variety of legal reasons, we have relationships with certain vendors. If you choose to work with one of those vendors, then very simply, you apply, do some paperwork with us, you have the work done, you never have to touch the money, you never have to worry about the money, you don't pay the vendor. We pay the vendor directly. They send us a bill every month, just like the utility bill comes every month. We pay them every month. Your college is spared any financial burden whatsoever. So That's certainly the much preferred process for our colleges these days. There are a number of vendors. I want to give credit to the vendors with whom we do work here. If you're familiar with this kind of business, you'll see very familiar names up there, some companies that are active all across the country. And my contact information is there. And as Terry said, these slides are up online, and we'll be happy to take questions afterwards. I've got some brochures here up at the front table if you'd like to take home some hard copy information to share with your folks at your state systems, or if you're with a California Community College and you'd like to apply for some funding, we'd be happy to help you out there. And otherwise, I'm going to turn it over to Sean.
All right. Thank you, James. So my name is Sean Keegan. I'm the Associate Director for Assistive Technology at Stanford University. I'm going to be using the phrase "we" throughout my presentation. That is because this was a collaborative project. Our office was involved, as was the Stanford Online Accessibility Program, which is managed by John Folio. The "we" is he and I. I'm going to be talking about a system that we've set up. So a little bit different than what James had been describing in terms of a system-wide effort. Stanford is its own system. And we came up with a model to kind of support the local campus issues as it related to captioning. And this started out as a project, a pilot project, focused on universal design for learning. And we identified a couple of different areas that needed some attention, one of them being the rise in online videos and how we would address the accessibility issues, captioning being a big part of that. We went around to a number of different campus entities who are all producing content, and they gave us a variety of answers as to why they were not captioning. Some of them flat out said, we didn't even know we could. Some of them said, it's too expensive. We don't have the technical expertise. We don't know how to do all these captioning things. Takes too much time. My favorite phrase that they'd always throw around too is, it's an undue burden. Like, okay. And the other part of it, though, that really struck home was that they didn't really see any benefit. You know, I don't have any deaf students in my class. Why should I worry about it? So there was a lot of assumptions that people had and kind of preconceptions. And so what we looked at trying to do was come up with a system to make things really simple. And basically, we saw this as a workflow issue. We're producing videos. We can produce captions. How can we match the workflows so that we can create these media assets that are accessible and usable to a wide audience? Not just for students, staff, faculty, or the general public that are deaf, but for all users. So I've got a diagram up on the screen. I'm going to walk through this really quickly. This is just kind of a schematic overview. What we have is a web-based system, okay? And what we like to make the comment is that if you can upload a video to YouTube, you can use the system. It's that simple, okay? You have a content author, starting in the upper left corner of the screen. Your content author will upload an audio file or a video file. Okay, they took video, they upload it into our system. And what they do is they then select how fast they want a transcript back. 24 hours, 2 business days, 5 business days. And there's price points associated with that. So if you want something done really, really fast, it's going to cost you. Right now, one business day turnaround is $5 a minute. I think we have a 3 to 4 day business turnaround. It's about $1.35 a minute. Okay, so people get to pick the price point which they're happy with. So they upload their video, they choose their price point, and then the system takes over. And so what happens then is that the system will send an MP3 file, an audio recording, off to the preferred transcription vendor. Okay. At the same time, the system then turns around, takes that person's video, the content author's video, and we re-encode it to web-friendly formats. Right now, we're producing FLV, Flash Video, MP4, And we've just added WebM, Google's codec, that they've released for free. We also return the MP3 file. Okay. So the system takes over and does that processing, and the users basically at this point uploaded a video and said, yeah, this is how much I want to pay. What happens then is the transcription vendor actually just creates a transcript from that audio file. They have their own separate web interface. They upload the file back in through their web interface, and that's when our system takes over again. We then match that transcript to the actual recording of the media file and then send out back to the user. We give them a variety of different caption formats. Right now we're producing DFXP, which is basically the time text format, and SRT, it's called subrip format. These are very common formats. They can be used in a variety of media players out on the web today, and they're compatible with a large variety of authoring tools for captions. We also return back something that's a little unique called the SCC file. For those of you that have ever done captioning before, you'll know what an SCC file is. It's a beast, to put it bluntly. It's also the file that the iTunes U really likes, unfortunately. So we return that file back as well, an SCC file format. And the user has to go through a couple of steps if they want to include that caption format for their iTunes content. And we also give people back the text file. So we give them back a variety of caption files. We also give the user, the content author, a sample media player, an accessible media player, as well as HTML code. So quite literally, all they need to do is copy and paste the code into their web page and make sure they have their video files and their caption files up on their web server, and it's all done. Pretty low mess, low cost, and we try to keep it as simple as possible. So at this point, the user, the content author, has uploaded video, chosen a price point, and then gotten a bunch of files back from the system, which then they just upload to their server. We run two servers. One is a standard web server, does the business logic and hosting the files and the databases. And the other server is what's called the DocSoft AV server. DocSoft is a company based in Oklahoma, and what they specialize is in taking audio content and doing speech recognition as well as time stamping. And so we work with them to kind of customize this solution. And I'll give some cost information later. We've got a couple of different examples, and I'm not going to click on the links and go through them. You can take a look at them online if you'd like. But we had a couple of different groups that we approached to kind of pilot this project and try this thing out. And the first one was the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford. They did a lot of short-form videos, your 3, 5, 7-minute content, you know, what students are doing in public service. And so we added them to our pilot project, and they basically started the captioning process. One of the features that we built into the system was that if you gave the system a transcript yourself, there was no cost to you. So you could run a video file and a transcript that you produced yourself through the system, and there was no cost. And so that was actually the preferred method of the Haas Center for Public Service. They had some student interns. They wanted to do some projects. They worked on captioning. We also found that other entities were interested, so the Graduate School of Business got involved. And their model was doing basically longer presentations. So people from hedge fund companies, marketing directors, they would come in and give presentations for about an hour, hour and a half. So we did some of the longer form videos. Those would exist both on Stanford as well as their YouTube channel. So we wanted to see what the impact would be there. And we also basically went out and just captioned a number of videos, some online courses that had been done in the past, just to see, once again, what would the impact be, and also how painful would it be. One of the things that we found was that people were really interested in the YouTube model and the solution. So they'd run their content through our system before uploading it to YouTube. And the reason YouTube became popular, it's not the only distribution method, but it's one of the more popular, is because of some of the things that Terry alluded to earlier and mentioned specifically in the opening presentation, was that you can do a lot more with it. Not only can you search for content, you can search for information based on the text transcript, the caption file, but you can also have an interactive transcript. So this is something that exists. If you've got a caption file, you'll have a text transcript and, I'm sorry, an interactive transcript where you can actually read through what the presenter is saying and click on the specific topic of which he's discussing. So the specific text which he's saying, it will jump the video to that point. A lot of people can read faster than they prefer to listen, so they can scan through looking for what's the specific information they want to hear and then jump to that specific point. The other part, which really sold a number of users, was the ability to have the language translation. So once again, if you've got a video on YouTube that has captions, you can do the Google Translate function on it, and it will return back the caption information in the preferred language. Really popular with some of the distance education areas that are doing, you know, video presentations in South America and Pacific Rim countries. So some additional resources that are available through the presentation, I highlight a few of them simply because these were useful to us and maybe useful to you as well when trying to identify some of the issues with captioning. My contact information, and look forward to any questions. Thank you.
And my name is Alice Anderson. I'm with the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I'm also talking just about media, not the live classroom captioning, although as a result of the process, which is a very long process that the University of Wisconsin-Madison has been engaged in, we formed an amazing collaborative group of people and have just recently, in the last couple of weeks, addressed the need for live real-time captioning for a distance ed engineering professional development course. So we look at Madison. It's a campus. It's a large campus. But the metaphor for the campus is a bunch of silos. And within that, those silos, there's often little silos, and there's many silos that you don't get to see. So there's the business school, there's the letters and science, there's the UW Communications, which is the face of our campus. All of these silos had representation in this process that I'm going to explain to you. What you don't see on these little silos are law school and some of the other large entities which aren't very engaged at this time in captioning or distance ed. So the thing about Madison is it's large. It was it's an old university, beautiful campus, 900 and some acres, 43 students, give or take. A lot of money goes in and out of that campus. 18% comes from taxpayers, so even though it's a public education, the monies are not all coming from taxes. And we have Chancellor Biddy Martin, who is concerned very much, and rightly so, with how are we going to continue to deliver first-class education. So the story starts in 2001, and it should have ended there. That's when the University of Wisconsin-Madison developed a web accessibility policy. And as a part of that policy, it included video and audio files that should be captioned. But it didn't end there. For the past 10 years, I, who work at the Division of Information Technology, work with the Disability Services Office, and we conduct a student disability survey every year, and we ask them what's working, what's not working. And time after time, it's those PowerPoints are problematic that the faculty put on the web. They can't read them, those PDFs that are image files. And what's been slowly creeping to the top of their list are we need some captions and transcripts for the many files that Terry talked about that are now being delivered in the classroom and then put on the web. So why is the University of Wisconsin-Madison not captioning? The group that I had mentioned that's been getting together is what Sean said. It's too hard. And it costs too much. It's too hard because we have so many different files and we have so many different needs and the output, and we don't have the money. So if you get us the money, we'll address those problems. But we did it the flip-flop way. We tried to address it's too hard. There used to be a free tool, there still is, a free tool called Magpie. First it was just PC. And then it was, now it's cross-platform. But on our campus, a young man developed a world caption tool, works on a Mac only. It was really a fun tool. It still works. If you've got a transcript, you can literally take that transcript text file, throw it into his tool, and it pretty much synchronizes it. You might have to tweak it and get your output file. It wasn't still the solution. One, it's a Mac-based. Two, there are a lot of different files that people were working with and a lot of different file outputs that people wanted. So we needed to still work on a campus solution which was going to address all of this. And we needed a transcript. So in 2008, there was some money that I found to do a pilot, which is asking the people in the silos, what are the caption files that you're working with and what do you need? And here's some money. Let's do a sample. The results of this pilot, which showed some commencement addresses, some keynote speakers on campus, some courses, some DVDs, every file that I could think of and more that I couldn't think of that were submitted and worked with, and then the people who worked with it gave us the results. We worked with Automatic Sync Technologies, and overall, the people at the table were very happy with the results. So word got back to the campus that we were doing this and that captioning probably was going to gain some momentum. And on our campus, the state legislature says if you're going to purchase over $5,000, you're going to need to have a contract. So you better get a contract. And thus the process in 2008 started of getting a contract to do captioning and transcription for media. And it's a long process. We had to identify the requirements. Nobody else had done this. I asked every colleague I could think of and some that I didn't think of, what are the requirements? We had our campus group and they understood from their perspective what they needed, and so that's how we had to piece it together. Then we had to put a scoring criteria. What's the most important? And again, the Disability Services Office was at the table, and this was key, I think, to our success, because they understood the urgency when there was an urgent matter. It's one thing for me to have a file and to say, well, I'm going to put it up there captioned sometime as soon as I can, but it's another to have a student who is in a class that needs that file, and it needs it quickly and in oftentimes different formats. So then we had to identify vendors and let them know that we had this RFP ready for them to respond to. We had to score it. We had to do this independently. It's a very heavily monitored process, one that I thought was going to break the friendships that we're forming, because I promised people we'd probably get together three times, three meetings. It turned out almost 2 years later and several meetings. And they're still talking to me, and that's a good thing. And then we did some anonymous testing. We submitted identical files to the finalists in the RFP process and got friends from out of state to submit it and to do it simultaneously at the same time. So we were trying to be very systematic. And then we had some student workers evaluate the transcripts and the file that came back. And that was part of the criteria, and then, of course, costs. So we ended up with a score, or the references was another piece to that RFP process, that was pretty identical. So we awarded two contracts. Well, that created more work in many ways, but the competition proved to be quite good. Automatic Sync Technologies, which was part of the pilot, came in as one of the finalists, and 3Play Media. Both of these vendors are here in the downstairs, and I encourage you to talk to both. in all honesty, on paper, they both look really good, have a few different features, but we don't know yet because it's September 1 is when they finally finished this process. And as a part of the process, it was no longer UW-Madison. We asked the vendors to agree to let the entire UW system draw off of this contract. So the rest of the campuses didn't have to go through this painful process. The slide that you see now is a state of Wisconsin and the different 2 and 4 year colleges throughout the state that are able to draw off of this campus, off of the UW-Madison campus contract. The contract language is available online. It's not as informative as the actual requirements, but it does give you a contract number and the legal language. And again, those are on the slides and available for the public, or you could come into UW-Madison and start Googling and find that captioning transcription contract. So the process really just started. People are not rushing to get their media caption because we haven't solved the money problem at this time. We're working on it. We'd like it to be part of the campus services, just like your email, your file storage, your learning management system, all of the other enterprise systems. We'd like to be able to have people captioned. But it's not happening yet. The links that you see now show that we asked each of the vendors to create a web page. The first one, media transcription captioning, when if you're a UW-Madison or outside of UW-Madison, you can get in there and you can see what the vendors have put together for the page explaining what their services are, also the login. Then the team said, let's do a side-by-side comparison because it's too complicated. And so we created the second link is a vendor comparison side-by-side. It starts with price, of course. Well, it happens that both vendors agreed to reduce their prices. The prices are the same. So what the criteria is that people will choose, we're not sure. Within a year, we hope to have some follow-up information as to who used which service and which vendor or both should get their contracts renewed. And that's basically a two-year process, a long process. But if I were to say anything that was helpful as a result of this was the collaboration across those silos where people have built up trust and confidence and can solve problems very quickly now by shooting out an email to this group or calling up the person they know who's using MediaSite Live or doing a certain thing.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions. So anybody who has a question, please take a mic.
Good afternoon. I'm Robert Wyatt. I'm the director of distance learning at Western Kentucky University. And I guess I could preface it, what we would say in Kentucky is, hey, y'all, it ain't that hard. Why are you guys using vendors to do this? We've actually captioned thousands of hours of video using undergraduates who use these little wave paddles and just listen to the video, type it in. And what I say about funding undergraduates is that we get the money right back because they go downstairs and spend it at the food vendor or at the bookstore. I think if I cost it out, it's about 50 cents a minute. So we have undergraduates that listen to all the video. We just know where the video is on servers. They listen to it. We wrote our own little time stamping program, which is real basic. It just kind of counts how many characters there are, knows how long the audio is or video is, and then puts the time stamps in you know, whatever kind of format, all different media formats, because that's just some slight XML differences. And then we have graduate students that re-upload it to the server in the appropriate way. And I'm saying it costs like 50 to 75 cents a minute. And I'm wondering why everybody's outsourcing to these vendors when transcription is typing and the students are plenty capable of doing that.
You guys want to respond to that? Sean?
So that's actually something we looked at Stanford. Couple things we ran into. In terms of undergraduate students, we actually have a very small undergraduate student body. We've only got about, I think this year there's about 8,200 students at the campus. For the volume that was being produced, there was no option. Not only that, but students, unless they were getting some type of internship or some other type of credit, there wasn't a real interest to, even for pay, to do that. They had their studies, they had other things that they were focused on. So if they could do it as part of a project or something like that, we found there was interest. And in that case, they were making the student rate.
Yeah, and let me interrupt real quickly, too. A lot of times we'll take students who are actually taking the class, and guess what they say? If I go listen to this class and then right. type it, I'm
exactly.
killing in the grade. Well, and so you can almost entice them that way.
What we ran into in terms of Stanford is that we weren't getting a lot of and specifically addressing that, we weren't getting a lot of classes that were being recorded. These were more presentations and so on, short-form videos and stuff like that. When I've gone back and looked at our logs as to who's doing what, about a third of all the videos that are going through our system right now are being done at no cost. Someone's actually just sitting down, doing the transcript, and sending it off. So that's about a third. Out of that third, the majority of those tend to be 15 minutes or shorter. Most of the content going through is 60 minutes or above. And right now we're doing a little over 20 hours a month, still in the just coming out of the pilot project phase. So we didn't find a lot of interest on behalf of the students to do it. If you've got their ear, excellent. Keep using it.
Similar problem is where we were going to house it. It's still being talked about. Who was going to manage it? Who was going to manage the students? And the workflow isn't nice and easy. Like, I can't just hire 10 hours each week at this time. And the file types that the faculty and staff that support them wanted was more than what we could do for a startup operation. So that was why Wisconsin didn't go that route. We do have some cases where classes have X number of hours of lecture, and they do have students as extra credit transcribe those, and that's a different story.
Yeah, I'll just say that it sounds like a great idea, and I'll try to implement that in my own institution. But for Matt, in terms of the California Community College grant project, that explicitly comes with the connection to the vendors.
Lorraine Frost from California State University, San Bernardino. One of the areas that I'm trying to work on right now is developing a captioning policy. I've heard a few people suggest maybe guidelines instead of a policy at this stage. But one of the components of that is ensuring that we have permission by the original author of the media. So I wasn't sure if your workflow also includes that copyright clearance.
John?
So let me answer the first part of that question about a policy. We intentionally did not start with a policy at Stanford. By design, we tried to find a solution first by which we could craft a policy around. There are some advantages to top-down approaches, but we already have, the silo type model as well, lack of collaboration. We thought we'd give people a tool, test it out, see how it worked, and then take a look at the policy aspect of it. And that is something actually that is being finalized and developed. We're going to start with our division and then branch out from there. So, and people don't have to use our system for captioning. They can do whatever they want, but we give them a low cost or free way of doing it in order to meet the policy standard. With respect to permission, no, we didn't worry about it. we're only dealing with content that's being produced in-house. We're not dealing with content that's from, we got a DVD from somebody else and re-ripped it. We're not dealing with that. In fact, we handle that in a slightly different way. Our focus was on web-based materials, content that was going to YouTube, departmental web pages, or the iTunes U platform. And in that case, because these were faculty, staff, university individuals presenting the recording the content and presenting, we didn't worry about copyright issues in that regard.
Our campus did start with the policy. The policy says anything on the web that's based on 508 language, your media needs to be captioned. So if it's on the web, I assume whoever put it on the web has answered that question. The faculty who have had those concerns and expressed those concerns are using learning management systems. So yes, it's on the web, but good luck trying to get to it. And what they do on the web is like what they do in their classroom. It's really not my business, and I don't have time to make it my business. The other is the student who is getting an accommodation. The disability services folks are dealing with the copyright on that, or the lack. They don't really need the copyright. They need to provide the accommodation. And that's provided to the student, not necessarily to the entire class. So I'm hoping that gives you a little bit of insight as to how to handle that.
And I'll say for the California Community Colleges, there is clear legal guidance from the system office, from the chancellor's office, that the media does have to be captioned. Prior to doing the captioning, the college has to ensure that it has the copyright clearance to do that. However, from the perspective of my office and administering the grant, that we leave that up to the colleges. We inform the colleges of what their obligation is, but that's not for us to enforce.
Great. Well, I want to thank the panelists and thank you all for coming to the session.